So let me start with just a few specific points of agreement. Maybe that's a good place to start in any debate, so we have at least a common ground that we're working from. I came up with 8 points that I think that James and I are in agreement on. James will have to correct me if I'm wrong, but let's try these. So number one, the Roman-Jewish conflict is of central importance in the whole Christian story. I think that's pretty clear. Two, we have good reason to know that to believe the Jews generally hated Roman rule, and they wanted them out or they wanted them overthrown. Third, as well, on the other side, the Romans generally disliked the Jews. We have a lot of evidence of that. But they were tolerant rulers. They tried hard to tolerate their Jewish subjects. Fourth point of agreement, I think we both would say it's unclear if a historical Jesus ever existed. I tend to think there was. I have some reasons for that. I guess we'll look at that a little bit later. We can talk about that as appropriate, but agreed. It's a pretty vague concept that there was a historical Jesus. But I think we both agree that there was certainly no biblical Jesus. So we're talking about the divine Son of God walking on water and raising the dead. I think we're pretty clear that biblical Jesus never existed. Sixth point, Jesus, Paul, the 12 apostles, all the main characters in the early Christian story were Jews. It's basically a Jewish milieu. They're either actual Jews or Jewish characters in a story, but it's basically a Jewish environment in which this whole context emerged. Seventh point is that the timing of the four Gospels is very suspicious. It's highly unusual, certainly not what we expect. We'll talk about those later. And the eighth point is on Paul. I think both of us would agree that Paul was somehow a dishonest character. He seems to have had ulterior motives for what he did, and that's really what we're trying to get at, one of our main objectives here today. So if those are our basis of agreement, we have some disagreements. We have two competing theories, I think, about how to explain things. So we have, on the one hand, my Jesus hoax theory, and James's theory, which I'm not sure I have a name for. I just called it the PSYOPs theory. Maybe there's a better name for it. I'll let him explain that one a little bit better. But I thought I would give, say, a three-sentence version of my theory, and then my interpretation of James's theory, and then I'll let him critique and correct me as needed. So here's my theory in a nutshell, Jesus hoax theory. Paul and the gospel writers took the story of an ordinary crucified Jewish rabbi and turned him into the Son of God, the Savior of all humanity. They did so strictly to suck in the hated Gentiles to their new pro-Jewish religion, to weaken them morally and spiritually, and thus to undermine popular support for the hated Romans. Therefore, the Jesus story was a true hoax. It was a fraud and a lie intended to deceive and harm the Gentile masses. Paul and the gospel writers are thus rightly seen as masterful and malicious liars. So that's my theory in a nutshell. James's view is somewhat different. This is my interpretation. Certain leading Romans, including perhaps the emperors themselves, decided that they needed a psychological ploy to restrain the unruly and rebellious Jews in Palestine. Therefore, the Romans constructed a new religion for the Jews based on a likely non-existent but divine Jesus, who instructed everyone to live a passive and law-abiding life. The reward for this was happiness after death in heaven. Beginning, and I'm not sure when we'll have to talk about this, but beginning maybe with Claudius around the year 40 AD, the Romans enlisted a few militant Jews, Paul first, and then others, James, Peter, whoever else we can name. The Romans enlisted them to sell the new religion to the militant Jews in order to pacify them. Later, certain unnamed Romans wrote the Gospels attempting to reinforce the Jesus story. But unfortunately, it failed, says James. At least we know from history, right? Paul was executed just as the first Jewish war began around the year 66 AD. Post-war efforts also failed, given that we had a second Jewish war in 115 and a third Jewish war in the year 135. So clearly the plan didn't work. But nevertheless, in the end, the PSYOP religion, Christianity, survived, was adopted by many Gentiles, and ultimately by the empire itself. So that's my take on James' theory. I'll let him correct me if I'm wrong. Let me give then for my remaining few minutes, the essence of my argument, because I want to get a little bit of the details going here. I think we have two main problems with the traditional Jesus story. On the one hand, we have the problem of the evidence. Secondly, we have the problem of the chronology. The problem of evidence deals with what we do not have. Namely, we do not have evidence for a miraculous Jesus. Really nothing at all, right? We have no evidence, no confirmation of any of the 36 miracles of Jesus. We have no contemporaneous evidence of a Jesus existing at all during the time when he supposedly lived. In fact, completely, the whole period of time from the year zero, or whenever Jesus was born, to the year 50 AD, we have nothing. We have literally nothing. No documents, no letters, no engravings, no relics, nothing. And this is the Son of God who's come to earth. And there's not a shred of anything that exists. So this is a big problem. The problem of the chronology. Well, if we look at what we have Paul's letters. Those come very late in time. They come as early as the year 50. They run until Paul's death in the late 60s or 70. These are two or three decades after the crucifixion. The four Gospels, which tell Jesus' life story, come even later. I think we'll agree on the standard timing. Mark was about the year 70. Matthew and Luke came about the year 85. John came about the year 95. Very late, decades after the time of Jesus, totally what you would not expect on a standard biblical reading. And the non-Christian readings that should confirm the biblical story also come very late. So the earliest non-Christian writing that we have is Josephus from the year 93. We have Tacitus and Pliny who are writing from the year 115. These are very late in the process, highly suspicious. The whole story just does not add up from a chronological standpoint. So I think, what's the best explanation? So for me, here's my best solution. So Paul, we know, was Jewish. He was a militant Jew. I think probably he was a zealot as well. And surely, as a Jewish elite, he hated Rome just like all the Jewish elite. That's almost certain. But I think he somehow determined at an early point that violence was futile. It was pointless to fight back physically against the Romans. So he concocted a stealth plan. He wanted to appear pro-Roman, even while he was pro-Roman, to avoid being attacked, and maybe even to earn the favor of the Romans in a very sneaky sort of way. But he did want to attack Rome, not directly, but indirectly, via the masses, via the superstitious, Gentile, non-Jewish masses. So he constructed a story of a Jewish demigod, Jesus, who came to save the Gentiles. So this is the story. He sold them a story of Jewish monotheism, a Jehovah God, not a Roman pantheon. He used a carrot and stick approach. He said, believe me and you get to go to heaven. You don't believe me, you're going to hell. And he used his letters to encourage his fellow Jewish Christians with a subtle message of resistance and rebellion, even while he was appearing peaceful and law-abiding. And I think we can give some evidence for that. Later, just to close the story, the Jewish gospel writers, they took up Paul's cause. They made Paul into a hero. Paul's powerful. He's influential. He performed miracles. I don't think people even realize that Paul raised somebody from the dead in Acts. I mean, it's pretty amazing. They added details of Jesus' life, Jesus' miracles, and they continued with messages of resistance along with little bits of peaceful talk as basically cover language. So one of the main things that we're going to get to is the messages of resistance, which I think there are many, and we're going to contrast that with the supposedly pro-Roman messages, which I think are actually relatively few.
Thank you so much for the opening statement there, and we'll go ahead and pass this over to you, James.
Thank you, Derek.
And yes, sir.
Thank you, Professor Scrivina. It is really a privilege to be discussing this important topic with you. And really, thank you, Derek. You do a vital service to the human race. And I guess it's good to start with where we do agree. That is always my practice, to start with where we agree so we can hone in where we disagree. And I basically agree with Dr. Scrivina about this. We agree about a great many things. We both admire classical Greek civilization for its secular worldly approach. We both believe that Christianity was a principal factor, at least, in the collapse of classical civilization, specifically the Roman Empire. we both believe that the New Testament is largely fiction. That is to say, cannot, and by fiction I mean most of the things Jesus is quoted as saying could not have plausibly said been said by historical Jesus. So we agree about a great many things. And it is vital that we ask the question, if it is fiction, what caused it to be? And again, we have a tremendous agreement, as he indicated, in believing that the Jewish wars of the first two centuries are where we should look. It is no accident that Christianity emerged at this very moment in history when there is a religiously motivated war between Messianic Jews and the Roman Empire. That 30 years ago when I began looking into it, more than 30 years ago when I began looking into this, that was what really struck me, that the two could not be accidental. So we have substantial agreement about that. And where we do disagree is about the motivation. And there are several factual differences I have that I think have been brought up just here. The message of peace is the predominant message throughout the New Testament. The message of resistance is the underlying bleed through of the earlier rebel movement. We both agree that the earliest layer of Jewish Christianity was the rebel movement, in effect. They were Torah Orthodox, as the debate in Galatians, Paul's letter to the Galatians reveals, that Paul was in a heated debate with the previous apostles, and this was over Torah adherence, over issues like kosher diet, eating with Gentiles, circumcision, and much of Paul's writings concern, for example, our relationship to the Torah. For Paul argued that the death and resurrection of Jesus has completely altered our relationship to the Torah, and we are now free in the law, he argues, and things like circumcision and kosher diet need no longer worry us. And furthermore, Paul argues that even as he's arguing that Torah is to be questioned and criticized, he's arguing for complete obedience to the Roman state. At Romans 13, one of the authentic Pauline epistles, one of the oldest portions of the New Testament, Paul requires Christians to obey the state. Here he means the Roman state, in light of his criticism of Mosaic law. He means the Roman state, not just to obey them as a matter of practicality, but as a matter of religious obligation. It is a sin to disobey the government. He goes that far. He goes so far as to say that the government, the Roman government, are God's appointed agents on earth. This historically is the source for the divine right of kings, which Christian kings for many centuries to come, Christian governments for many centuries to come, would cite as the basis for Christians having to obey the state. Taxation is a religious obligation that you pay your taxes, not merely to get along. And rebellion is a sin as well. It's a sin. It's not merely impractical. Nowhere does Paul state that there's any kind of passive resistance as a motive to this. He never suggests that this is somehow some plot to bring down the Roman government. Quite the contrary, if one were to think he was trying to save Judaism and to have Judaism prevail, at least culturally, over the Romans, he would not have so taken apart Judaism. And by taking apart Judaism, I mean from the roots up. Every distinctive feature of Judaism, kosher diet, circumcision, strict Sabbath observance, is going to get attacked in the New Testament. Sudden, sweeping, simultaneously, all of these changes to the Mosaic law are made in the New Testament, either by Paul or by Jesus. And this is significant because, of course, this is the principal motive for the Jewish rebellion. They wanted space to practice, just as Muslims today, many jihadist Muslims today want to practice Sharia law and make it the actual law of the land. So it was that Jews wanted the law of the land to be the Mosaic law. And as Professor Scribina pointed out, at first Romans tried to accommodate that. And before the Jewish War of 70, Jews were able to enforce the Mosaic law. Their own Sanhedrin could enforce Jewish law, even the death penalty. But that couldn't continue after the Jewish War, when Judea was completely reduced to provincial status. But Paul is arguing against the previous Jewish Christians for a loose approach to Torah and for peace with Rome, obedience and submission to Rome, outright submission to Rome. And since he is arguing against an earlier Jewish Christian movement, which are the ideological rebels, I think we agree with that. The previous Jewish Christians were militant nationalists, and of course, militancy and nationalism would both take a direct hit in the New Testament. Throughout the Gospels, Jesus is attacking Jewish exceptionalism point blank, attacking the very notion of God's chosen people. Professor Scribina in his book does a great service of lining up the Roman, the anti-Jewish Roman writers in the first century BC, the first century the Common Era, and it delineates the Roman complaints of the Jewish people at the time. their monotheism lies at the root of this, but it's more than that. It's how they treated their monotheism. They were sectarian. They were antisocial. They were misanthropic. They separated themselves out in their sectarian. They believed themselves to be God's chosen people. The principal objection that Romans had with the antisocial Jews of the period was taken on directly in the New Testament, pulling out by the root Jewish exceptionalism. But this even begins in Paul's letters to the Galatians. There is no Greek, there is no Jew in Christ. So the very ethnic division of Jew and Greek is attacked in the very earliest portions of the New Testament, Paul's letters, but they receive really concrete fleshing out in the New Testament. The dominant theme of the New Testament is peace, not war. While Jesus says, I did not come to bring peace but the sword, it's not a justification for you to do violence as a Christian. It's saying simply what the effect will be of his coming. And of course, that was the effect of Jesus' coming. Jesus instructs his disciples, for example, to carry swords. But I would indicate to Professor Scribino in his book, when he quotes that section, he doesn't quote the full section. Jesus actually goes on to say, but don't carry more than one sword. And why do we carry swords? Simply so that we can be numbered among transgressors, so that we can be considered bad guys. In other words, Jesus is saying, I need to fulfill the suffering servant prophecy found in Isaiah, where he will be wrongfully accused and be numbered among the transgressors. If the original Jewish Christian movement was a rebellion movement, then many of their sayings and attitudes are going to bleed through into the New Testament. And the militancy that I think Professor Scribina notes, for example, Paul's self-identification as a zealot, can all be explained by the fact that Paul was at one time a member of this violent, militant, nationalist movement. But rather than a means of bringing down the Roman Empire, Professor Scribina believes that this talk of peace is merely a tactic, another tactic in effect in the cause of the Jewish rebellion. That makes little sense to me. The New Testament strikes me as a critical reaction to the Jewish rebels of the first two centuries. They're militant, nationalist, sectarian, Torah orthodox, and that's really the underlying motive here, rebels. And Jesus takes on every single one of those. Paul takes on most of those himself. Torah orthodoxy, you name it. The simple fact is that what we have of militancy in the New Testament is simply a bleed through of the rebel ideology. It's clear that the disciples are, in my view, overwritten stories of rebels, of Jewish messianic rebels. And we come now back to the concept Messiah. Messiah was the rallying cry of the rebels. Most of the rebel leaders were messianic claimants. One of them said he would part the Jordan River miraculously, as Joshua did in Hebrew scriptures, and claiming to be a Messiah. Jesus' warning against false messiahs is specifically a warning against militant rebel leaders, in my view. So the entire portrait of Jesus as the Messiah is itself a pro-Roman thing, because it's transforming the Messiah into not a military leader, which is what all Jews up to that point expected the Messiah to be, a political military leader. Simply the portrait of Jesus as a peaceful rabbi is itself an assault on the Jewish rebels and their thinking, that you've got the whole idea of Messiah wrong. He was a peace lover. He said, render unto Caesar. And it's not just render unto Caesar and pay your taxes. He befriends tax collectors. One of his disciples, Matthew, is a tax collector. Jesus says of a centurion, not just a Roman, but a Roman centurion, that his faith exceeds that of any Jew of the period. Now, this was a period of Jewish rebellion, a Jewish rebellion. It would be like a jihadist leader, like Osama bin Laden saying that this American GI fighting in Afghanistan has more faith than any Muslim on earth. A more pro-Roman assertion probably could not be found. And in all of the particulars of the New Testament, in at least four different occasions, slaves are told to obey their masters, even harsh ones. Why? It's a salvation opportunity. It's a salvation opportunity. Why? Because whoever's last here on earth will be first in the kingdom of heaven. And this kingdom of heaven thing is being used to defang the militancy of messianic Judaism. Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this earth. You have nothing to worry about, Romans. The Messiah's kingdom is in another dimension altogether.
Thank you, James. Got to cut you off, brother. Thank you so much. Hey,
I'm
you
sorry,
guys.
I missed the tone. I'm sorry.
you're fine. No, you're fine. Thank you so much. This is a great opening statement from both of you gentlemen. And now we can go ahead and go right into the rebuttals. Dr. Scribina, if you'd like to go ahead and get us started, this is fun. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So several points to either ask questions on, James, or to maybe to give you an alternate view, right? So I guess the main thing is we have to keep in mind the possibility that the facts that we agree on could have different interpretations. So just because you have a given fact doesn't mean lends itself to only a single interpretation, right? So the same fact could in fact support two competing theories and principles. So I think we need to keep that in mind. Again, some things I would agree with. You said the New Testament is anti-Jewish, and I would agree. Because on my theory, it's targeted to the Gentiles. You're not going to write a pro-Jewish document and target that to the Gentiles. You're going to write something anti-Jewish or at least neutral, because otherwise you're not going to draw the Gentiles in. Of course, they're not going to talk about Jewish exceptionalism. Same thing. You're not going to talk about that if you're writing for the Gentiles. That doesn't make any sense. You don't want to play up the Jewish chosen by God. You're trying to draw in Gentiles. So that makes perfect sense from a Jesus hoax theory. Another point that jumped out was that you're saying Paul was a zealot at one time. So my question to you is, what caused him to change? On the traditional view, he had a vision of the risen Jesus and he had a theological conversion. I don't think either of us accept that. So the question is, why did Paul change from being a militant zealot to now being a peace-loving, pro-Jesus character, right? And I guess I'm saying, well, look, he came up with a better idea. He realized that militant, violent resistance was not going to work. So he goes to his fellow zealots and says, look, you guys, you're being violent. They're just going to kill us. This is not going to work. We need something else. To me, that makes perfect sense, right?
Perhaps, go ahead. Perhaps you're accepting Paul at face value in his own you agree that Paul's a liar. Let me suggest
gentlemen,
to you that what
gentlemen.
He's asserting.
Gentlemen, we're actually doing cross examinations after the rebuttal statements. Okay. This is during his rebuttal, and then you get your 10-minute rebuttal. Then we'll do cross exam. I'm sorry.
Sure.
Thank you so much. Sorry.
That's fine. I just had a couple more points, and then I'll turn it over to James.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
So the question was, what caused Paul to stop being a zealot, mm-hmm. right? So I guess James owes us an explanation. I think I have a decent explanation. Well, look, he came up with this better idea, a better plan to oppose violence against the Romans. When we say things like Jesus takes on so-and-so or Jesus adopts a certain attitude about things, we have to be very careful because we have no confirmation. We have no legitimate basis for really knowing what Jesus said about anything, right? Because all those sayings, what Jesus said, Jesus did this, these all come from the Gospels. And these are decades later, they're written by known liars. So we have to be very careful. We have to hold everything that we say, well, Jesus did this or that, we have to hold it with a huge grain of salt because we can't really trust anything. All these guys, whatever they said that Jesus said or did, serve their interests. So, and that's a general rule, right? That's true about Paul, all the gospel writers. These guys are basically proven liars. So we have to be very, very careful what they say, whatever they have said in writing, probably is self-serving. And we need to look at it all in that light. So I think that will make a big difference about what we claim about what Jesus said and did. So that's a few points for starters. I mean, later on, I want to get to, I have several reasons why Paul was not pro-Roman. I want to look at those, and I want to look at the specific messages of resistance and weigh those against the pro-Roman statements. So I want to get to those later, but maybe, James, if you want to tackle those first points for now.
If Paul was within the Christian movement, he was soon to be an enemy of that very Christian movement. His debate in Galatians shows how quickly he took on. He, in fact, indicates how little human contact he had with previous Jewish Christians. And he indicates how fierce the debate was. He confronted Cephas to his face. James, the leader of the Christians, had to spy out Paul's freedom in Christ. Paul is damning the previous Christians, no less than condemning them to hell. So that kind of intense debate between the early Christians, I think, is not a fake one, but it was an early one. And Paul apparently had fundamental differences with these Christians. First, he was let's get the order straight. First, he attacked the Christians, then he became one of them. That is to say, if we're going to understand the Jewish Christians as the zealots, And when he says, I was zealous for the law, what he has to say that because, of course, he's going to be the great critic of the law. And he's focusing on, boy, I was zealous for the law, whether it's he's zealous for the law or a zealot. Either one makes sense here because he would, in fact, infiltrate the Christian movement. After persecuting this Christian movement, he then infiltrates it. And the Christian movement he infiltrates is the zealot movement, the militant movement of Christians, which were the Jewish Christians before him. And he takes on all of it. He argues for peace with Rome at Romans 13 and elsewhere. He argues for submission generally. And he argues against strict adherence to the Torah systematically. He also gives us a man-god, something unprecedented within Jewish thought, radically different and very pagan, very Roman, a man-god, the worship of a man-god, an alien thing that to be introduced right now, and a definitely Romanizing, paganizing element. And so I would say that if Paul was merely engaged in a different tactic, I'm wondering what his tactic was to do, since was it to bring down the Roman Empire? I do not believe he could have realistically believed that urging Messianic Jews at the period to be peaceful would have the effect of bringing down the Roman Empire. And more than that, he's destroying Judaism as he knows it. He's changing what it is to be a Messianic Jew. So what are we? Who's winning? We're becoming Romans. And when I mean becoming Romans, I mean really becoming Romans. Paul's ideology, Paul's philosophy is so similar to that of the Roman philosopher Seneca in many particulars that Christians in the Roman period forged a correspondence. It's obviously a forgery, but they forged a correspondence between Seneca and Paul, who were contemporaries. Seneca the Younger, of course, was a Stoic philosopher of the first century. He was Nero, the Emperor Nero's tutor and chief minister for the first few years of his reign. And of course, he was a Stoic, but he was a mystic Stoic. He believed in the golden rule. He believed in compassion. He was skeptical about money. In many ways, Seneca's ideas are echoed in the letters of Paul, and that's just for openers. On Roman coins in the first century, for example, they'll feature in their religious political propaganda, Pax Orbis Terrarum, peace on earth, or Spes, hope, or Clementia, mercy. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men, which is what Jesus' birth is said to bring about in the nativity story in Luke, of course, echoes the very ideas that you'd find jingling in your pockets if you were a Roman of the first century. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men, concordia, harmonia, mercy, clementia, hope, all that. It strikes me that Paul isn't coming up with a new idea to undermine the Roman Empire by any means, because when the Christians do take over, they don't want to destroy the Roman Empire, do they? Nope. When Christians do finally take over the Roman Empire, they want to preserve the Roman Empire. And it is pagan barbarians who come in and conquer the Christian, now Christian, Roman Empire. And when the medieval Christians get their act together in the year 800, what do? They crown Charlemagne the Holy Roman Emperor again. In fact, the Roman Empire is what's holy to Christians for the better part of the last 2,000 years. So the Holy Roman Empire exists until, 1807, the Napoleonic Wars. So, whereas Christian society over the last several centuries has been distinctly anti-Semitic. And that anti-Semitism traces itself to the stories and the message of the New Testament itself.
Well, with James, let's look, guys, there was supposed to be a 10-minute rebuttal.
But I'm so sorry.
It's okay because here's the deal. Both of you guys, you got a little more time than Dr. Scribina.
So
let's do 5 more minutes if you have on rebuttal, unless you guys want to go ahead and jump into a prosecutee type Q&A where you guys can crosstalk if you'd like. What do you guys want to do?
That might be better.
It sounds like you guys are ready to interrupt.
I think we are. Yeah.
So okay, we're past the rebuttals, and what we'll go ahead and do then, gentlemen, is we'll go ahead and go into the first 5 minutes where you will prosecute James, and James, you'll be on the defense. I will hit the timer here. Give me just 1 second, and then we will switch and do the same vice versa. And if I need to interject or have to cut in, I will, but hopefully you two gentlemen keep it as civil as possible, and we don't have a new 70 AD occur here online. So. Ready, set.
Okay, well, so James, I guess to make it really simple, narrow question. So Paul changed. He changed his view from he was a zealot, Was he not?
He belonged to the zealot movement. First, he persecuted them. He persecuted the Christians. And the Christians before Paul were militant, right? Torah Orthodox right. militants. So he said, at first, I persecuted Christians, and then I joined the Christian movement. Oh, in other words, so, he's an enemy of them all along, even as he's infiltrating them.
So let me ask this question. So
yes, sir.
When in time did he change, and why exactly did he change?
He never changed in his heart. He was always against these guys, and even his infiltration of them. First, he persecuted the militants, probably as a Roman agent or a Herodian agent. And then he gets the idea to infiltrate them, become one of them. To go under deep cover. And I like your word psyops because it does convey my view of Paul in a certain sense. I suspect Paul went under deep cover into the Christian rebel movement. Because they were the rebel movement, that's where the Romans needed intelligence. And they needed ideological intelligence. And so they sent in someone who had previously been persecuting those Christian zealots, and he became one of them.
But still, even on your theory, Paul made a switch because he was not anti himself. He was true. Not anti-Jewish.
Well, that's and true. He regarded himself as a Jew throughout.
Something happened. The Romans got to him. How did they get to him and when to turn him to become anti-Jewish? That's what you're trying to say, right?
Step one in his career, as he describes it, is he persecuted Christians. So he began.
Who were Jews?
Right. So he was Jewish. Well, a lot of Jews. See, this is another disagreement I have with you. Not all elites. And this is an area where I think you also mix up in the book. At one point, you say most Jewish elites were anti-Roman. Then you say all Jewish elites were anti-Roman when you discuss Josephus. And then you discuss the large number of Roman collaborating Jews. There was a large number of educated, wealthy Romans who worked with Jews, who worked with the Romans. The nephews of Philo, the great philosopher, for example. Were there with Titus at the siege of Jerusalem. You don't get more pro-Roman than that. And in fact, the whole Flavian propaganda of claiming to be the Jewish Messiah indicates that they were working with pro-Roman Jews. Yohanan ben Zakkai, the rabbi at Yavne, himself accepted Vespasian's claim, if only for political reasons, to be the Jewish Messiah. So there were lots and lots and lots of collaborating Jews. And they were well-educated. Just get that on the table. Paul must have been one of them to begin with because he opposed the rebels from the start. He was a Jew, one of the many Jews who opposed the Jewish rebels. And he told us that he persecuted them, the Christians. And before Paul, that's what the Christians were, right? And then he had a blinding vision on the road to Damascus. No, he had the idea to infiltrate the Christians and to undermine them. And that is precisely what he did. He became a Christian and then began arguing with them about things like Torah and peace.
So wait a minute. So you're saying he was always a collaborationist Jew like the Herodians. Is that what you're saying?
There's no reason not to think Paul was always working with the Romans.
From birth.
Right.
He was just raised that way or just that he just adopted
probably a wealthy, like so many Jews, so many wealthy and educated Jews, he was a Roman citizen, suggesting he was a wealthy, well-educated Jew, and like many of them, he was collaborating with the Romans. That's why he was persecuting Christians. That's what he says. I was persecuting Christians. Right. Okay. So he was opposed to those guys, right? He was persecuting certain Jews, as he admits at the start. And those are the rebels.
So who dreamed up the Jesus story of the Son of God comes to earth, dies, resurrected, saving all of humanity?
I do not know whether there was a historical Jesus. And I do not know to what extent Paul created, or the gospel writers created. Now, I know most of the New Testament is fiction that was created, but the extent, was there a crucified Jesus, for example? And for example, if he was crucified, he was not crucified for saying, pay your taxes, render unto Caesar, and blessed are the peacemakers, turn the other cheek. No, he was crucified as a rebel. And he was a Torah Orthodox rebel, if there was a historical Jesus. He was a Torah Orthodox rebel, and that's why he was crucified. So the passion story, as we have it in all four Gospels, is obviously Roman propaganda. Jesus is betrayed by Judas. He's convicted of violating the Mosaic law by the Sanhedrin. And of course, at the time, if that had been the case, they would have stoned him. The Jews had plenty of law to put people to death. They could have stoned him like St. Stephen. But no, they didn't. So the historical Jesus never had a problem, if there was a historical Jesus, never had a problem with the Sanhedrin and never violated Mosaic law.
Time to switch sides. Thank you so much. I had to cut you. You guys are, I like this. You guys are definitely bringing some excitement to this. I'm really enjoying the back and forth. And now you're going to be the prosecutor here, James, asking the questions, and Dr. Scribino will be answering your questions. And let's try, and you guys did, you did a very fine job there, Dr. Scribino, on focusing on only presenting questions rather than responding to his points. Let's keep that as much as possible. So when Dr. Scribina does respond, let him continue to answer and try not to answer his answers. Keep coming back with more questions, and then we'll do vice versa, which you of 17 years with law know very well. Thank you so much. Let's keep it going.
Okay. And just to keep with the trade I was on before, this would be my question. I do not think adequate attention is given the hoax to the passion narrative. The passion narrative of Jesus's execution and death is naked Roman propaganda on the face of it, in my view. Do you believe, Professor Scribina, that the crowd chanting crucify him, apparently in unison, three times, in all four Gospels, which finally persuades Pilate to crucify Jesus, or Pilate's declaration that Jesus is innocent in all four Gospels, or the fact that Jesus is convicted by the Sanhedrin in a kangaroo court, which they could have executed him from, or the betrayal of Judas. Do you regard that passion narrative, which during the Middle Ages caused mob violence against Jews, that passion narrative, and understood by the earliest Christians during Roman period, who analyzed like Origen and Eusebius, the way they understood the passion narrative is the Jews killed Jesus, and that explains why God punished them by losing the Jewish wars. They were defeated in the Jewish wars as a punishment for killing Jesus, the true Messiah. Do you believe that passion narrative is historical? And if it isn't, what is its motive, if not naked Roman propaganda?
So first of all, fair question. I think there probably is reason to think that there was a historical Jesus, a regular rebellious rabbi, because on my theory, Paul is not going to construct a lie around a nothing. It's much better to construct a lie around a kernel of truth than around a void. So it's much more likely to me that Paul's going to take an actual Jewish rabbi who was actually a rebel and was actually crucified and died and got buried somewhere, is probably still there today. That's a much better kernel for a hoax story than nothing. So that's, to me, that's the kernel of truth that we know there. The whole passion narrative that you talk about, we have to keep in mind, comes much later. This is well after Paul. Paul knows nothing about a passion narrative, right? It's decades later, right? So the whole Jesus story is well underway. Supposedly the Romans have constructed the story, and it goes for decades, and no one knows anything about rising from the dead and this whole thing, right? So to me, in my view, the reason why both the Jews and the Romans are portrayed as enemies is because, in fact, they were. Because Paul's group of peaceful, peace, supposedly peace-loving Jews, he's opposing the rebellious zealots, and he's, of course, opposing the Romans, who he hates because they're ruling over his territory and they've plundered his treasure and so forth. So in a sense, Paul and his friends have two sets of enemies. They're opposed by, in a sense, they have antipathy towards both those elite Jews and towards the Romans. And so this becomes embodied in this little story did the Jews kill Jesus, or did the Romans kill Jesus, or they both had something to say about it. It's a little bit of a confused kind of a story the way you read it. But to me, that comes much later because that was the essence of the complaint, right? It's not something that was part of the original story of Jesus. It came much later in time.
We have a minute and 40 seconds.
Okay. I would say that the fact that it comes later, I agree that the story was constructed late in the first century, or later in the first century, probably later than when Paul was written in its details, but there's nothing that I can find that's anti-Roman about it. It seems designed to exonerate Pilate and to make it seem like Pilate was preventing a little mini rebellion right there and really had to do it and was forced by the Jews. In fact, Matthew, we don't need Matthew to say this, but has the crowd again say in unison, his blood is on us and on our children.
Is that a question there, James, that you're asking?
Okay. Yes. So I guess the question would be, what is the anti-Roman part of the passion narrative? It was only in the 20th century did the Pope forgive the Jews for killing Jesus. So it was never understood until Hollywood got its hands on it that the Romans killed Jesus at all. That's a totally contemporary Hollywood sort of notion. Do you really think that there's something anti-Roman in the Passion narrative? If so, what is it?
Well, so I don't know if we can point to anything specific in that particular aspect of it, because we don't see those stories. What we see there is more just the power of the ruling Romans. I don't know that was probably an objective in that little vignette that we see in the couple of Gospels where that's recorded. I think really what we see there is sort of the antipathy towards the ruling elite Jews. We see that more. We see the kind of the condemnation where they're destroying the Jesus story. They're killing the Jesus story, which Paul and his friends are saying, well, how dare you do this? How can you do this? This is going to be our salvation. This Jesus story is our salvation because it's going to get to the Gentiles. So I think that's the crux of that particular little story. Necessarily anti-Roman per se. In fact, very little is directly anti-Roman. We don't see that. We see indirect stories of an ideology and a worldview which is anti-Roman, and that's what I'm going to get to when I can get to that next. So that's what we see. It's not get out there and attack and blame the Romans.
Thank you, guys. All right, we went through the first round of Q&A, prosecute, defense, etc. I'm going to go ahead and change this to a gallery view. That way it's not just exclusively one person. They will be able to see your facial expressions, which is going to be really good because, you know, I saw a couple heads nod while one guy's talking, and, you know, it makes it a little more Jerry Springer-like, if you will. So thank you so much. Let's go ahead and switch sides again. And if you don't mind, be on the offense, Dr. Scribina, by asking some good questions. And James, here we go.
So I guess, James, you're trying to tell us that the story was targeted at the Jews. That I think this is your claim, that this constructed Jesus story came from the Romans, maybe from the Roman emperors themselves. I still don't really know when. I mean, are we all the way back in Tiberius? I'm trying to figure out exactly when and which particular emperor decided in his head that he's going to construct a Jesus story and sell it to the Jews to make them meek and mild. I still don't really understand how that's going to happen. I guess that's my question, right? So how is that going to happen? When, which emperor decided that he's going to create this story and get this to be a persuasive story for the Jews? Because you're telling us it was written towards the Jews.
Right. I believe the Gospels were written under the auspices of the Flavians as proof texts for the Flavian claims to being the true Jewish Messiah. But I think the movement began earlier in the reign of Nero. And I believe Paul was, in effect, doing psyops for the Nero administration. The idea probably did begin much earlier. This was standard Roman tactics. The Romans would, of course, co-opt foreign religions and use them to justify their own political legitimacy. Perhaps the most famous example being Virgil's Aeneid. You know, the Romans absorbed the cultures of the people they conquered, most famously the Greeks. And the first dynasty of Roman emperors used, in effect, Greek religion to provide them with legitimacy. They were the descendants of Trojan princes, the goddess Venus, and so forth. And the whole story of the Aeneid plays out to explain the Julio-Claudian legitimacy, in effect, using a foreign religion. It's my contention that the Flavians did much the same with Jesus, putting most of the detailed flesh on the bones, as you just indicated, of the Jesus story. The Jesus story, the essence of what Paul has of the Jesus story is very thin, right? Born of a woman, crucified, may have had a Last Supper kind of right, but that could have all been from Paul's vision. Paul has almost nothing of a, as you point out quite accurately, almost nothing of the story. All he knows is that there was this crucified and resurrected Jesus, really. And that's all that matters to him. But of course, it would have been very convenient for him to cite the Gospels had they existed. They would have helped him in his argument with the Galatians, right? And one of the reasons we know that Paul wasn't as a Pauline as described is that debate in Galatians. So I would say it happened in the reign of Nero. I would say it's standard Roman practice. If there wasn't a Christianity, I'd be looking for the pro-Roman version of Messianic Judaism. It would be a lacuna. But Christianity fits that niche so well that it's clear to me that that's what it is. I mean, it's written in Greek, truly for both Jews, but also we know there was a great deal of proselytizing activity. There were Gentiles who were being converted to Judaism before Christianity started proselytizing. We know this. For example, the royals at the court of Adiabeni in the Near East, they were converted from their paganism to Judaism back during the lifetime of Jesus, the alleged lifetime of Jesus. So we know that very important converts to Judaism were occurring at this time. And so the New Testament was aimed both at Jews who were rebellious Jews, but also anyone who might be a God-fearer or subject to being converted to Judaism. The population of Jews in the Roman Empire is much larger, a portion, than, say, the Jewish population in America today.
I'm going to add a minute to this Q&A, because I know that Dr. Scribina wants to ask a...
Go ahead and feel free to interrupt
if you need to.
Please.
Ask questions.
But yeah, I do believe it was aimed at Jews, but also, in a way, at Gentiles, to allow for the existence of peaceful Messianic Jews and ease off the attack on them. Yeah.
So I don't see how it could have been in the reign of Nero, because Nero assumed power in 54, and this is right near the end of Paul's life. And Paul clearly was writing before that. So it had to happen in the reign of Claudius at least, if not Caligula. And if we believe Paul, if he's not too big of a liar, and he had this miraculous vision, that was back in the year 33, that was the reign of Tiberius. So the plot must have originated in the Romans way back at the time of Tiberius. This is way before,
Why does the plot have to originate back in Tiberius? Maybe Claudius, but I'm fudging on that because I'm not too strict on the dates of Paul. You see, I'm not sure. Paul, I believe, and tradition has him living into the 60s. And interestingly, Acts doesn't tell us about the date of his death or the manner of his death. We only have second century sources telling us. Maybe Clement of Rome alludes to it. But Paul is certainly alive. Tradition holds him alive at the Great Fire of Rome in 64. Paul's most of his writing, for example, the letter he's writing to Rome and from Rome in some of his letters, and that doesn't occur until around 60 or so. So Paul's writing activity may not have occurred until well into the 50s. There are some, it's possible. That's why I say maybe Claudius, because Claudius did deal. He had to expel Jews because of the Crestus thing. Now, obviously, that's not Jesus Christ that Suetonius is referring to, causing disturbances in Rome, Crestus, but a rebel leader, right? What it shows is Roman confusion over the term Christian or Christiani and Crestus. First of all, Jesus wouldn't have caused violent disturbances. He was a peace lover. Turn the other cheek. Love your enemy. Submit to the evildoer. Blessed are the peacemakers. It's over and over and over the message of people. Whoever picks up the sword shall die by the sword. The entire Jesus apocalypse is a dire warning against rebellion. The peace message and anti-rebellion message is the loud megaphone in the New Testament, not militancy.
So do you give any credence to Paul's supposed conversion on the road to Damascus, which supposedly happened in the year 33? Do you give any credence to that at all?
No, I do not believe Acts is a historical document. Acts' chronology is wrong in most particulars. It gets things messed up. Look, Josephus says John the Baptist wasn't executed until, 36, 37? So that's after the crucifixion. So the Gospels are all screwed up in chronology, and Acts is particularly bad in chronology, and the road to Damascus story is particularly suspect.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you so much. All right, let's switch sides here, just like Paul did on the road to Damascus. Let's do it.
The effect of Christianity was to bring down the Roman Empire. It is true, but this was an accidental effect in my view. No one could have foreseen that Christianity in the first two centuries, that the New Testament, one, would have taken over the whole empire, right? Obviously, it's aimed at only people who want to worship Jehovah, worshipers of the Jewish God. If you're not interested in worshiping the Jewish God, it has no particular relevance to you. And so I have a hard time believing that anyone would think at the time of the composition of the New Testament that it would take over the Roman Empire, much less bring down the Roman Empire. I agree that religious intolerance associated with Christianity would help petrify and destroy classical civilization, but that was surely an accidental effect that no one could have foreseen. And so I guess one of my main objections to the thesis that you bring about is that this was an anti-Roman tactic. I do not see how it conceivably could be thought of as an anti-Roman tactic. When Gandhi, for example, used nonviolent resistance, he said on the face of it, look, this is designed to bring down the Raj. The British can't rule if we don't cooperate. And guess what? They're Christians. And if we get headlines in their newspaper, and they're a sort of democratic country, so if we can get democratic reaction in Christian culture. See, I don't think Gandhi would have worked against Hitler or Stalin. It worked against the British Empire.
Please phrase it as a question, please, okay. James.
So do you really, since there is no indication that this is some form of passive resistance, do you really think that people could have conceived the Christianity as taking over the Roman Empire, much less bringing it down in the first two centuries?
Well, right. So obviously, I don't think it was a takeover plot, because that would have probably been inconceivable. But you can certainly understand that they would try to undermine the moral basis, maybe the spiritual basis, or even the intellectual basis for the Roman worldview. I can certainly believe that. And certainly in the local region of Palestine or Judea, right? Maybe not in the entire empire. And so the Jews of Palestine, they just wanted the Romans out of there. That's really what they wanted. They didn't want to, you know, obliterate the entire empire. That probably would have been inconceivable. But if they could have eroded the local support, because the Romans, they didn't have millions of Romans in Palestine. It was a very small number of people. And they relied on the good conduct of the local Gentile majority, the non-Jewish majority in Judea and Palestine. So I think it would have been a viable plot to say, well, look, we need to erode local support for these Romans, ideologically, spiritually, through a sort of a new concept of a god. I think that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, it's even that's okay. It's not.
Would it undermine? I guess I need to know that mechanism, because It didn't undermine their belief in the Roman Empire. Christians embraced the idea of the Roman Empire and wanted to preserve it and restore it, recreate it over and over. So Christianity had no effect in terms of making Christians anti-Roman or against the Roman state. And I would also add that there is so much of classical philosophy. See, the way I would look at it is that Christianity is a form of Neoplatonism, right? Don't store up your treasures here on earth, where they can get corrupted and rust and so forth. Store them up where they're imperishable in the kingdom of heaven. My kingdom is not of this earth. The Messiah has nothing to do with this dimension at all. And so it seems to me that Neoplatonism generally was on the rise. That
question, James, question, brother.
Let me just get there. Mysticism is generally on the rise, and Christianity was just the vehicle that did take over. But in effect, it's a vehicle for classical ideas like dualism and Stoicism, logos, and so forth. So what Christianity does is, in effect, embrace Hellenistic culture, assimilate into Hellenistic culture, doesn't resist it. So in what sense would it even be realistic to think that it's taking down classical civilization?
So everything that we read in Paul is to me is anti-Roman. Paul is clearly anti-Roman. He wants people to love the Jewish God, Jehovah, not the Roman God. He wants people to love a Jewish rabbi, Jesus. Okay. He is a self-proclaimed disciple to the Gentiles. He's working on the Gentiles, not the Jews. That's who his audience is. He has allegiance to God, Jehovah, not the emperor. The whole worldview of Christianity as it's constructed by Paul and his friends is an anti-Roman worldview. They're promoting meekness, pity, the nature of the afterlife, this passiveness, a kind of life-denying outlook. These are all anti-Roman aspects of an anti-Roman worldview. We furthermore know that Paul is anti-wealth. He speaks out explicitly against wealth. He speaks out against power, against worldly power. Paul himself was killed by the Romans, so they clearly weren't happy with him. And we find, if we look exactly at the details, and we'll get to that in a few minutes, Paul says almost nothing that is pro-Roman in his many letters. There's one little passage in Romans, and that's it. So there's multiple reasons to think that Paul was in fact clearly anti-Roman. I guess that's my answer.
Looks like we got 15 seconds, so I don't know if you guys want to switch sides again.
Let's the 15 seconds.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
I think we can be generous with the 15 seconds.
Well, I'd like to have James answer the respond to those points. But there's several strong
all those things are very Roman. The Roman emperors wanted to hurt the rich and help the poor. They were inheritors of the popular party. And furthermore, Josephus, for example, admires the pro-poverty, the communal ownership. Just as we read in Acts, Christians had held their property in common, so did the Essenes, and Josephus admires it. Josephus admires the sexual abstinence. The Romans loved meekness, mercy, pity. Pliny the Elder, in his praise of the Roman emperors, Flavian Roman emperors, said that there was their self-sacrificial fatherly love, their compassion for the ordinary people. Julius Caesar, when he died, gave a bounty to the ordinary Romans in his will. Augustus, his heir, sold all his possessions like the rich young man to make it possible. No, they fed the multitudes just like Jesus fed the multitudes. Very much the all those ideas that you listed off, rattled off as anti-Roman. No, pro-peace? Well, the Romans struck coins for peace. Pax. Pax orbis terrae. Peace on earth. Goodwill toward men. Stoicism was very much, and Neoplatonism even more aggressively in its dualism, anti-material, anti-money, anti-the body. And these were classical ideas that had already had its roots in classical, as much as we admire ancient Greece, Professor Scribina, the ideas of Christianity are basically classical philosophical ideas. They're the ideas of the Stoics and the Neoplatonic philosophers put into practice.
Christianity, but the Romans were not anti-wealth and anti-power. They were in the embodiment of wealth and power.
But they admired hermits, but they admired ascetics. Oh, yes. And one could, it's very much like Christians. You could admire the poverty without practicing it yourself. You could admire the celibacy without admiring it yourself. No, indeed. In fact, as I said earlier, Seneca's ideas and St. Paul's ideas, distrusting money, the golden rule, that sort of thing. The austerity of Stoicism even was beginning the increased mysticism of Stoicism by itself. Monotheism. Let's even go monotheism. Philosophical monotheism was already well underway with syncretism, the fusion of gods, the cross-identification of gods. We hear it in Virgil. We hear philosophical monotheism. It had nothing to do with Jewish monotheism. In Seneca.
Yeah, but that was clearly not the religion of the time. The religion of the time was a polytheistic pantheon of gods.
Well, that's
Paul
true.
wants people to love monotheism.
But monotheism wasn't the Roman objection. The Romans would have been happy to have monotheists in their culture, and they would have been tolerant of them as well. They didn't mind philosophical monotheists. They didn't mind Jewish monotheists per se. What they didn't like was the sectarian nature of Jewish monotheism, how being God's chosen people made them standoffish.
Christianity takes that apart.
Of course, Christianity destroys every aspect of Jewish sectarianism. It destroys the entire notion of Jewish exceptionalism. I don't think a Jew would come up with the get rid of all Jewish exceptionalism. In fact, when Jesus praises the centurion's faith as great, being greater than that of any Jew, not just a Roman, but a Roman centurion, he goes on to say, but of course the Jews, there'll be much suffering and gnashing of teeth and wailing, whereas people from all over the world will come sit at feast with Abraham. And over Jesus says preach to all the world. Jesus' foils are always Jewish authorities, never Roman authorities.
But why? Answer
Same with Paul, why, by the way.
Right. But why would Paul, who's the self-proclaimed disciple to the Gentiles, why would he promote the idea of worshiping a Jewish God and a Jewish rabbi named Jesus? Why would he do that?
Well, he is promoting it to people who are already susceptible to worshiping it. He's not going to make any headway, okay? But in any event, if he could make headway with them, he's turning them into good Romans. Tax-paying, non-rebellious,
to love Jehovah,
and a matter of sin.
That doesn't make you a good Roman. To love Jehovah and love Jesus? No way. How's that?
Romans really don't care who you worship, nor how many gods you worship. The Romans of the period could not care less. They're happy to deal with Jews. They're happy to deal with philosophical monotheists. It's not a question of how many gods or which god you worship. The Romans really didn't give two figs whether it was Jehovah or even whether it was one god. What they cared about were the underlying causes of that rebellion. The messianic prophecies, there's the Torah orthodoxy, the militant sectarian nature of it. And Christianity directly addresses every single one of those points. It takes apart militancy, Jewish exceptionalism. It introduces this man God, which is a totally Roman thing.
But Paul is the Jew.
Paul is turning them into Romans, worshiping a man god, a mystery cult, with all this Hellenistic philosophy that echoes Seneca's and Plato's.
Yeah, but it doesn't, it doesn't, to me, it doesn't make sense when you're a disciple to the Gentiles, when you're going to the Gentiles.
Well, be careful. Paul has both. Gentile Jewish converts. And the Gentiles he's converting obviously are susceptible. And besides, if he succeeds in converting them, they're good Romans. They're tax-paying, peace-loving. They're good Romans. They're the perfect. In fact, what Paul in the New Testament done is checked off a wish list, a Roman wish list of changes to Judaism. In the first century that Romans
Wanted. Time. I love this. I don't want to stop you. You know what I mean? But I have to because we stick to the rules. So we've gone through three rounds of prosecute defense, and this is really good. We're on to round four. I think six rounds. We'll see how we feel. If you guys still have a lot of fervor going on, we might go to seven, and then we'll do a
Well, the Holy Spirit has come upon me, Derek.
You guys are filled with the Spirit today. I love it. All right, switch.
So is it my turn?
Yes, and do me a favor, James, please. We have 5 minutes, so
yes,
try really to quick. Make your question. Okay. I know you're trying to explain for audience as well. Of course. It's kind of where you're coming from. But what I'm going to do, Dr. Scribina, if his questions get a little long, I might interrupt, and I don't mean it disrespectful just to say please. question. I might extend an additional minute to give you the time to answer James because he has pretty long questions. So.
Okay. Well, and I've gotten in a lot of what I wanted to say. I want to give Professor Scribina the floor here for a minute, sincerely. It was in my head to sincerely give him the floor. He indicated that there's all kinds of pro-Roman stuff in Paul or that he wanted to get into. It seems to me, of course, just the opposite. What we have is an anti-Torah, anti-militant message. In Ephesians, for example, which is was one of the pseudo-Paulines, but it still explains Paul's idea. The very wall of separation between Jew and Gentile is being broken down. The very difference between Jew and Gentile is being destroyed. There is no Greek, there is no Jew. So Paul's message, it seems to me, is one that says there's nothing special about being Jewish at all anymore. So what is it in Paul's letters that you say is defending Rome or attacking Rome and defending Judaism?
Okay, so let's look at the exact passages because that's important, right? We need to look at that. So both in Paul, and I've documented, let's say 14 of them I've got here, 14 passages that seem to be clearly messages of resistance. We see a little bit less in Mark. I have four passages in Mark, and I have another 13 in Luke and Matthew. So in total, I have 30 passages. I can just quickly run through them just to get a flavor of what's going on so we can see the general trend. So, and I'll try to do them sort of chronologically as best we know. So if we start with Paul, the earliest Galatians. So we see Galatians 4:8, wants people to turn away from the weak and beggarly elemental spirits of the Roman pantheon. At Galatians 5:1, he says, do not submit to the yoke of slavery. In 1 Thessalonians, he says, there's no victory unless the rebellion comes first. He uses a military analogies. He talks about the breastplate of faith and the helmet of hope in 1 Thessalonians, military language. In 2 Thessalonians, he says, Jesus is not coming unless the rebellion comes first. In Romans, he says, salvation will come to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. That's obviously the purpose. In Romans, he also talks about the military terminology. He talks about the armor of light, right? So he's talking about military concepts, metaphors. Paul himself says he will say anything and do anything to win the obedience from the Gentiles. This is Romans 15. In Romans 16, with luck, the God of peace will soon crush Satan. So who's Satan? Satan is the Roman Empire, right? In 1 Corinthians, the rulers of this age are doomed to pass away. The form of this world is passing away. That's the Roman Empire. 1 Corinthians says the end will come when God destroys every rule and every authority and power. That's the Roman Empire. 2 Corinthians, Jesus' power is made perfect in weakness. The weak ones, the meek ones, will be strong. They will take over when they succeed, right? Ephesians, put on the whole armor of God. Here's this military talk. The breastplate of righteousness, the shield of faith, the helmet of salvation, and the sword of the Spirit. So that's, to me, that's sort of really, you know, putting it in kind of rebellious kind of terms. Those are all from Paul. Now, if I say, what's pro-Roman about Paul? I have one passage. I have Romans 13. He talks about love thy neighbor, obey the laws, and pay your taxes. Romans 13 is the only pro-Roman passage in the 13 letters of Paul. And I just ran off over a dozen passages that are clearly rebellion, crushing the powers are fading. So I'm looking for the evidence in Paul. Maybe we can just take that piece first. Where's the evidence in Paul? There's far more evidence that says there's resistance and rebellion, and there's trouble coming against the Roman powers than there is to be pro-Roman. There's only Romans 13 on the pro side. So maybe I'll let you respond to that first, and then we'll look at the Gospels.
Okay, you're reading the Romans into a lot of things. It is true that even the Romans, one of the big differences that you point out is that, for example, with the Greeks over the later Christian worldview is the view of the afterlife. The Romans were heavy into the afterlife. Just compare Virgil and Homer's view of the afterlife, right? In Homer, Achilles says it's better to be a slave on earth than to be the ruler of the underworld. And in Virgil, we have something very, very different: rewards for the good, punishments for the bad, a very Christian worldview. And the Romans themselves were very, very fatalistic in their own apocalypticism. But they also regarded the Roman Empire as a sacred thing. For Paul at all to chime in with that, for Paul at all in Romans 13 to chime in and say no less that they're the agents of God on earth, this Roman Empire, that is to give the Romans everything they want, saying that there will be at some distant time some end judgment and the end of all powers is not particularly threatening to the Romans, nor would it be inconsistent with certain other ideas that Romans had. I don't see that as anti-Roman at all, nor do I read the Neoplatonism of distrusting the powers of this world as being necessarily just anti-Roman. It's anti the powers of this world. Satan, for example, in the New Testament, takes over Judas. Satan is behind the Jewish crowd demanding Jesus' death. The powers of this world are Satan working in various ways. Satan tempts Jesus with the power of this world, famously in the wilderness. Power, is a temptation. Power is something that Jesus resists, any worldly power, whatever. That is true. So when they talk about rewards for the meek, that's in the, because the first shall be last and the last shall be first. Your reward is in the kingdom of heaven. Here on earth, which is, I think, where the Romans really are most concerned, you are to submit.
But the fact remains, you have 8 lines in Romans that are arguably pro-Roman, have over a dozen passages across all of Paul's letters.
No, I didn't buy any of those dozen passages. You read in Romans. And in fact, when you quoted some of them, there's no word Romans in the Elemental Spirits quote, for example. You added Romans. The Romans are not mentioned, nor is any government mentioned. Elemental Spirits. And you read Roman government only into that, which I think is wrong. I think they mean all worldly power. I think they mean worldly power as such, the world, the earth, this dimension. So you can't read this dimension as Rome, which is what you did in each of those passages. On the other hand, the anti-Torah message, the freedom in the law message, the pagan, you say one little bit is Romans 13? No, that's the one bit in the authentic letters that says you must obey the Roman state as God's agent. Now, how do you square that with everything else? I don't know. But the fact is that there's nothing anti-Roman, nothing that says, hey, we're doing this to bring down the Roman Empire. Not anywhere.
Well, I just read 14 passages that were
Elemental Spirits does not mention Rome.
That was one. You got 14 more.
We'll go through all of them.
Here's the game plan, gentlemen. I love this. We're going to continue flip-flopping it. Yeah. James, he's asking you, and you're asking him. And I think, if you don't mind, I'll square the question again. It appears that Dr. Scribina has read off some passages that he's suggesting are pro-zealot against Rome, to take down Rome, and you're interpreting them in a different way. Maybe you can answer his passages from Galatians, 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, Romans, etc., 2 Corinthians, Ephesians. How do you answer that and interpret that differently than him, maybe?
Paul is saying that the powers of this world will at one point be taken down in a final judgment. Well, that's true. And when Paul is talking about salvation, he's talking about another dimension. He's talking about the end of times. He's not talking about the success of the Jewish war by any means. And when Paul, for example, uses armor analogy, notice he's not using Jewish armor either. He's using the Roman kit. Paul describes the Roman armor as the kit for the, well, for our spiritual armor. More than that, none of these passages says Rome is our enemy.
No, of course not.
We have the Romans 13, which you admit is a nakedly pro-Roman passage, but none of the passages you cite are anti-Roman. That is to say, the rebellion may have to happen, but that doesn't say how we stand on it. The world will come to an end. That doesn't say the powers of the world will come to an end. Satan, we can't read Satan as Rome. No, in fact, in the Gospels, Satan is the motivator of Judas. Satan is the motivator of the Jewish crowd.
Dr. Scribina, go ahead and ask your question. That's a good response.
Okay, so let's look at the Gospel of Mark. So Gospel of Mark, 8:35, whoever loses his life will save it. That's a call to surrender your life. Mark 10:31, the last will be first. 13:8, exactly. Nation will rise up against nation. 9:1, the kingdom of God will come with power. So these sound, again, like further resistance statements. Now, of course, it's difficult because Mark was written just after the loss of the temple, and the Jews were crushed in their first war. So we would expect maybe not so much overt aggressive language as we see in Paul. We would expect maybe a little bit more mild talk. But still, you see this kind of rebellious talk in Mark, which was written just after the Jews lost the first war. And if you say, what is the pro-Roman passages in Mark? You have one passage, Mark 12:17, render to Caesar that which is Caesar's.
No, it's all pro-Roman. No, in fact, none of what you said being anti-Roman is anti-Roman. You're reading in this nation shall rise against nation. Doesn't say anything against Rome. Jesus' apocalypse, in fact, predicts Rome will defeat the Jews in the Jewish rebellion. We know Mark was written after 70 AD because it discusses that destruction. And it discusses it, the Jesus apocalypse, in fact, discusses it in such perfect detail with the armies in the clouds, just as Josephus describes it. The false messiahs, the rebel leaders, the destruction of the temple with no stone lit on another. No, Josephus is describing the Jewish war, and Jesus' apocalypse is echoing prophetically, is putting retrospectively being put back in the past. But that's what's happening. Jesus is warning that the Romans will win. God is on the Roman side. The Jewish rebellion will fail. Your messiahs are false messiahs. I'm the true messiah, in effect, because and what is he? He's a peace lover. No, in none of those passages in Mark are anti-Roman passages at all.
Well, okay. Again, but remember, my premise is that this has to be a surreptitious attack because overt attacks were doomed to fail. So, of course, Paul and any of his fellow...
But we have we do have overt pro-Roman stuff. Jesus says that a Roman centurion has greater faith than any Jew. Yeah. Paul says that you must obey the Roman state as God's agents on earth. Jesus directly answers the rebels. The rebels think you can't both render unto Caesar and render unto God. You can't be both a good Jew and a good Roman. Jesus says the rebels are wrong.
But remember, but my premise is that you have to appear pro-Roman to keep your head on your shoulders.
Yeah, powerful rhetoric directly attacks the whole notion of rebellion. The entire philosophy of the rebels is being yanked, having its foundations yanked from under it by Jesus. You can be both a good Roman and a good Jew. You can render unto God what's God's and to Caesar what's Caesar's.
Okay.
You can pay your taxes. Jesus goes out of his way to make friends of tax collectors, to cavort with the polluted, to cavort with Roman, the kind of riffraff the Romans were bringing in.
Let me go on to Matthew and Luke, because I want to get to those few passages and see what you think about those. It's a similar story. In fact, being written around the year 85, we can expect an acceleration of the messages of resistance. And in fact, that's what we see when we look at Matthew and Luke. So here's some passages. So here's Matthew 5:5. The meek shall inherit the earth. Okay, Sermon on the Mount.
Just what the Romans wanted of the Romans, the Jews,
Hold on. Hold on. The meek will inherit the earth. The meek is not the Romans. If you're inheriting the earth, you're going to take power. The meek will rule. That's a revolution. That's a rebellion against the powers that be. If the meek are going to inherit the earth, the Romans ain't going to be there. That's a message of rebellion. Matthew 10:21, brother will deliver up brother to death. So it's going to be a violent fight. Jesus says, all who abandon their families will inherit eternal life. So he's bribing them into this conflict. Jesus says in Matthew 10:34, I've not come to bring peace, but a sword. You're familiar with that one. We talked about that. He says, I've come to set man against his father. He says, who is not with me is against me. He says, the gospel will be preached and then the end will come. This is quoting Matthew 24. So this is all talk of It's militant talk. Take on your, you know, go get your enemies. Come with me. We're going to fight the good fight. This is all what this talk is.
Blessed are the meek is exactly what the Romans want of the Jews, right?
Okay.
And you can say the meek are going to inherit the earth. And they do. If you join the Romans, you get the whole world. You're meek and you're peaceful with Rome. You get the whole world.
Let me finish. The Romans don't want the meek to rule at their expense. I can guarantee you that.
Well, where does it say at their expense? Well, where does it say at their expense? But meek is exactly what they wanted of Jews of the period.
What are they, suddenly Democrats, and they're going to have the meek and welcome on into the Colosseum? And
I don't know what you mean. If they were meek, they'd do trade with Romans and prosper like all the collaborating Jews did.
Let me finish the story. Let's look at Luke for a minute. There's a few quotes here. In Luke 4:5, the devil rules all the kingdoms of the world. So who's the devil? That's Satan. That's the Roman emperor. He rules all the kingdoms of the world. Jesus says in Luke 12:49, I came to cast fire upon the earth. 12:51, I came not to give peace but division. Luke 14:26, a follower has to hate his own father, his mother, his wife, his children. This is going back to hating your family. Luke 22:36, let him who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one. We talked about that before. The parable at Luke 19:27, bring my enemies here and slay them before me. So those are all militant, rebellious statements in Matthew and Luke. If I look for the pro-Roman statements in Matthew and Luke, I see almost nothing. I see the Sermon on the Mount that says, love thy neighbor and turn the other cheek. I see the story of the centurion's servant. And I see the little phrase about perish by the sword, and that's it.
James, I'm going to give you one minute to answer him. Go ahead and...
Okay, well, Christians understood the New Testament entirely different than Professor Scrivina did until recent times. Augustine thought that self-defense was not available, so you couldn't kill an even reasonable self-defense. It wasn't until the 13th century in Thomas Aquinas that Christians could engage in killing in self-defense, and even the clergy couldn't do it then. Quakers, Shakers, Amish, they got the message. It's a message of peace. It was a message that directly turned upside down the philosophy of the rebellion at the time. I do not agree that all those are statements in there. What we have in the earliest layer of Christianity are the rebels themselves. And that language is being turned on its head into a philosophy of peace. But the language of the militants is bleeding through, no question. But it's being transformed in nearly every case, such as the sell your cloak and buy a sword, but only one so we can be numbered among the transgressors. But don't use it, because whoever picks up the sword shall die by the sword. No, it was plainly addressed to as a critical reaction against the rebels, even though some of the rebel language is bleeding through.
Thank you so much, guys. That was round five. And you guys should be professional boxers here. We can do 12 rounds. No, I'm just kidding. Let's jump to round six. And I believe in this, James, you are the prosecutor with questions. So please try and make it succinct and to the point. Thank you.
This is the hardest one that I have to ask it. I really do have to ask it. And I don't want to maybe make anyone uncomfortable. I admire Greek civilization, as does Professor Scrivina. I do believe that Christianity would bring down, in effect, the Roman Empire, if only by accident. Help bring it down, if only by accident. But I do not take at face value Roman descriptions of Jews in the first two centuries. I think I have a considerable more sympathy for the Jews, who were, after all, being conquered and oppressed and crucified in great numbers, tortured and crucified in great numbers, and they were simply seeking political independence. So I think I have a little more sympathy, and I don't necessarily buy at face value the anti-Semitic assertions of Roman writers at the turn of the common era. And I wonder to what extent I read the part in your book where you say maybe we're too sensitive about anti-Semitism, but it seems to me that drawing conclusions, whether we're drawing conclusions like Professor Eisenman does that are Zionist conclusions, or whether we're drawing conclusions about the current condition of the Palestinians, I think it's wrong to use ancient history to sort of justify modern politics. And I did get a whiff of that. And so I wanted to give you a chance, Professor Scrivina, to sort of address that, because I could hear your critics saying that there's an anti-Semitic tinge.
Yeah, sure.
Your work.
Sure. Well, right. That's why I took some time to document it in my book, right? So it was not just the turn of the century. It went back several centuries, three centuries at least, prior to the time of Jesus. That we were seeing prominent individuals, Romans and other pagans in the area, and they're remarking critically on the Jews, the Jewish tribes, and their interactions with them. So it was a very long-standing, well-entrenched attitude throughout much of the what would become the Roman Empire by that time. It was not new news to anybody. It became more pressing when they had direct contact with the Jews. It was probably less pressing prior to that time, but after 63 BC, when the Romans move in and take over Judea, then it becomes a very direct issue. And then you see an acceleration of the anti-Jewish writings. I don't know what it means to say you can't take them at face value. I mean, these guys were talking expert writers. We're talking the greatest minds in history, and they documented their anti-Jewish attitudes. So that they knew that the Jews were superstitious, they were misanthropic, they were malicious. I mean, this is just what they're saying. So unless they were all writing in some coded language, I don't know how you cannot take them at face value. That was a longstanding, well-documented, and I documented in my book. These were well-entrenched attitudes.
They were cannibals.
And the Romans in no sense were predisposed to be pro-Jewish. I mean, at best, they're like, well, we have to put up with these guys because they're our citizens or they're under our control. But that doesn't mean they had any real affection for them, certainly.
There were instances of Jews and Gentiles having a great deal of affection for each other. Antonia and Marcus, the king Herodian Greek Marcus Agrippa, were like mother and son. But some of those ancient writers said things like they worshipped the head of a golden ass and they were cannibals. Their human sacrifice led to cannibalism, even in classical times. Do you take that at face value? Accusations of cannibalism?
I mean, they were doing sort of secret ceremonial rites, which I guess maybe they didn't know what was going on. And you can imagine there was some rumor or myth that works into those things. You don't know how literal the stories of slaughter, but they were certainly doing animal sacrifices. I guess the question is, did they also do human sacrifices? I guess there's some evidence pro and con for that, so remains to be seen.
And if anyone is engaging in cannibalism, of course, it's the Christians who are actually drinking the blood and eating the flesh of Christ.
Yeah, there you go. Right. Exactly.
Well, I wanted to give you a chance to because I know that that's got to be something that you face, chance to answer that. But thank you. This has been a great discussion. A lot of fun.
I had a few closing points, Derek, if I can get my end just to throw to see if James can respond.
Yeah, I'll give you 2 minutes if you'd like to respond to that, or because we're not done yet, just so you know, we're not done.
No, I know, okay.
Okay,
yeah, cool.
Absolutely, I'll go ahead and start us over with 2 minutes. Go ahead, brother.
So, okay, so James, you're trying to tell us that Romans became Christians. In your theory, that they were pro-Christian, that they created Christianity, the Romans did. I guess I still didn't hear how that actually happened. This is just sort of floating around the background, and I have no concept of how the Romans constructed this story and then sent it on a little boat or in a message in a bottle or across the Mediterranean to Paul and whoever and said, here, promote this among the Jews. I don't understand how that happened. I also don't understand because they must have known it was a made-up story about this Jewish rabbi who died and was raised to heaven. So clearly they knew it was a myth, right? They clearly knew that that was not true. He didn't work these miracles. They know that was nonsense. So why you're trying to tell us that prominent Romans became Christians. So why would they believe their own BS story that they made up for the Jews? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, obviously, I'm not quite sure what you're asking, but the fact is that the Romans were engaged in creative religious and literary religious activity at this time. This was the period, the first century, of course, the end of the first century BC, sees the development of the imperial cult for the first time, sees the first time Romans will worship a man as a god since Romulus in the person of the divine Julius Caesar. So this was a religious period of religious creativity. This was a period of religious fraudulent activity, if you will. But I want to also point out that it wasn't necessarily fraud. While the people who are constructing the cult of the divine Julius, like Augustus, have their own motives for doing so, the ordinary Roman definitely worshiped Julius Caesar in a sincere, pious way. After the assassination of Julius Caesar, the people constructed a makeshift altar. And when the Senate finally did declare him a god, official god, they had to clear that away to build the temple to the divine Julius. So people sincerely worshiped the divine Julius. And let me go further. Jews, being monotheists, sincerely needed an explanation for their defeat at the hands of the Romans. How have we failed? In the Old Testament, it's clear. Every time we fail, Babylonians will conquer us. Not because God is rewarding those polytheistic idol worshippers, because we have failed in the covenant somehow. Jews needed such an explanation. Sincere Jews. So there are people at the top, educated people, who may understand that there's a fraud going on, or they themselves may have some kind of pious fraud going on where they've deceived themselves. But in either case, what they're doing is convincing a whole bunch of other people. This is true whether they're Jews or they're Romans, whether it's the imperial cult we want to convince them of, or we want to convince the rebellious Jews that Messiah really is a concept of peace and another dimension.
Yeah, but there's no way to square the worship of the Romans emperors as divine with the worship of a Jewish rabbi as divine. Zero sense. There's no sense there.
Well, I don't understand. I don't even understand the question, because of course the Romans could. All you had to do was make a sacrifice in front of these. And there's no indication that early Christians, the pagan Christians, had a problem with that. In fact, we have lots of Christians.
You just told us that the Romans worshipped the divine Julius Caesar. Right?
They did sincerely. Many.
Several of the emperors declared themselves divine.
They did not declare themselves. Well, Caligula declared himself divine, okay, but it was normally after their death that the Senate officially. It was not cricket in the first century for Romans emperors.
Okay, doesn't matter. The Senate declared them divine after they died. After their death. That doesn't matter. That there's no way to square that fact with a Christian story which says worship Jehovah, the Jewish God, and worship this Jewish rabbi named Jesus. There's no way to square
that. I'm not sure about that either.
Well, how can that work?
You're importing later Christian ideas back into the first and second centuries. The first people who were Christians may have believed that Vespasian was the true Messiah and a man God, just as Jesus was a man God and the true Messiah. If Jesus could be a man God, how many man gods are there? The first people who wrote the Gospels aren't necessarily strict monotheists. In fact, the Gospels create such a problem with monotheism that the first issue that the Christians have to deal with when it does become the official religion of the empire at the Council of Nicaea is to square that Trinity problem. God is three and one, and what are we? Is there a Holy Spirit, a God, and then God is the Son? So it appears to be polytheism. For the first several centuries, we must have had Christians who were all over the block on the issue. It was only at the Council of Nicaea that we finally get squared away whether or not Christianity is monotheism. So I'm not sure I agree with you about that. There must have been Christians who could, for example, sacrifice before idols in the second century, or they couldn't have been part of the Roman Empire or the Roman army. Yeah. And we have evidence that large numbers of Christians were in the Roman army.
Yeah, but that would be
impossible by your way of thinking. Let me suggest that your way of thinking has to expand.
The
people who worship the Jesus in the Gospels maybe could worship Roman emperors too.
But it goes without saying that all the documentation, everything written is about worshiping Jesus and Jehovah.
Right.
That's 100%.
No man comes to the Father except through me. I am the way, the truth, and the light. Yeah,
right.
I am the path to salvation. But a lot of mystery cults claim that they were the only path to salvation. Roman mystery cults.
Let Dr. Scribina get his question in real quick.
But there's no way to square that fact with the fact that you're trying to say, well, somehow this was a surrogate for worshiping the emperors. There's no point of commonality there at all. You're worshiping a Jewish God and a Jewish rabbi, and suddenly that's somehow a stand-in for worshiping Rome and the emperors. That doesn't make any sense.
The only way that
makes sense is because you're trying to go to the superstitious masses. You're trying to get them on the Jewish side. You're trying to get them to worship the Jewish God, not the Roman God. Worship our Jewish rabbi Jesus, and not those Roman emperors. And you're going to do that by taking the message to the Gentiles. There's a document called the Didache. Are you familiar with the Didache? So this was a very early document, possibly even earlier than the earliest letter of Paul. And the title of the Didache is a letter as a teachings to the Gentiles. It's an instruction manual to Jews on how to teach the Gentiles. So there's a very early one more piece of evidence that there's this message. A pro-Jewish message that's being taken out of the Jewish community to the Gentiles to try to get them to believe in this Christian.
But that wasn't invented by Paul. But it was already Jewish proselytism, right? In fact, you in your book cite the persuasiveness. In fact, Romans are concerned about the persuasiveness of Jewish advocates, right? So in other words, we already have Jewish proselytism. It's not that Paul invents proselytism to the Gentiles, right?
We have no evidence. What's the evidence?
We have lots of evidence.
We have specific names
of people who are converted to Judaism before Christianity came around. Yeah, no,
but this is not before the time of before Paul converts,
yes,
or whatever.
Yes, before Paul, the court of Adiabene.
But we have no documentation.
Josephus tells us that the pagan rulers in the early first century were converted to Judaism. We also, you yourself in your book, quote people who say that the Jews were effective in their rhetoric and persuasive. And effective. Those Jews were effective in their persuasion. Yeah. Oh, that's evidence right there of Jewish proselytism before Paul.
Well, they're being converted to Judaism.
That's right. So Paul is taking over a sort of mission to the Gentiles. He's not inventing it. Moreover, the worship of Jesus may or may not be consistent with the worship of other gods and accepting at least the worship of the emperors. Because remember, all the Romans want of the Jews is not polytheism. They'd be perfectly happy for them to continue in their monotheistic ways so long as they were peaceful, so long as they paid their taxes, so long as they could make their sacrifices in the presence, so to say, of an image to the emperor. And that's all they required. That's all Pliny the Younger's letter suggests was required. Lots of Christians might have been able to pass Pliny's test from my way of thinking.
And then the last document, I guess, in my favor is if I look at the book of Revelations, everybody agrees that's clearly an anti-Roman document. It talks about Babylon. Babylon is a surrogate for Rome. So there's no doubt at that point that we're talking about criticism, condemnation of Rome, the Roman Empire, Rome is the devil.
Remember, there's no canon. So we don't know. Many Christians in the first and second centuries may have only used the Pauline letters. Some may have only used Matthew. Some may have used Mark and Luke and Acts. Some may have used Revelation. Some may not have used it at all. There's no question that Revelation is primarily based on an earlier form of Jewish literature, apocalyptic literature. So the apocalypse of John is really just an echo of the earlier Jewish apocalypses, such as we found with the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, it's clearly militant, Jewish nationalist apocalypse. And so there's little surprise to me that anti-Roman language finds its echoes, the seven heads of the seven hills of Rome. Little surprise to me that we find bleed over from the rebel language. As Professor Eisenman has demonstrated to my satisfaction, the New Testament takes previous Jewish rebel language, such as we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls sectarian documents, uses the very language, turns it upside down and on its head to the exact opposite purpose. So while the purpose of the original language was pro-rebellion and anti-Rome, the language has been turned successfully on its head into a pro-Roman message and anti-rebellion message.
This was so good. You know how many times we should have probably switched and I just said, dude, I gotta let them hash this out. So I have a question as a host I'd like to ask, and then I'd like us to do another round where we'll flip, and James, you can ask Dr. Scribino, because he's asked many questions, and, you know, you've given a little bit of your thoughts in there, but I think it was predominantly you kept, you know, asking questions and James kept responding, which was good. It was a great interaction. Question that I have, just a basic, simple one. If this was meant only for rebels and, you know, it's meant to take Rome down, why did Romans adopt this view even in the early second century at all? Like, did they misunderstand it, do you think, or do you think for
were Romans who were...
Let me ask Dr. Scribina first, because he's got the pro-rebel idea, and I just wanted to get your thoughts. Did they have is there something in the Gospels, or what is your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, right. So, I mean, that's a good question. Why did the Romans themselves adopt this nonsense story that we both agree is nonsense? Why did they adopt that story, right? So it's something about, obviously there was a persuasive power about this story of eternal life and the fear of going to hell and all your sins are taken away. So obviously this is a compelling story. It's a good story. There's no doubt about it. It's total nonsense, but it's a good story. And you can imagine over time as that gets believed that you can see that would seep in even to people even within Rome. So I guess I'm not too surprised over time that as that idea circulated and got absorbed by the masses, that occasionally the Romans themselves and even the Roman elites would become drawn to this idea of eternal salvation and perfect happiness with God. But to me, that makes no sense if that was a Roman construction, because then as I say, they're believing their own lie. And to me, that makes no sense. I can understand on a hoax theory how they would come to believe it. But if they were the source of the myth, why would they themselves believe the myth? To me, that's the big question.
Well, the Romans were the source of the Julius Caesar divinity, and they were the ones who believed it. See, it's not the Romans. There are certain Romans who are putting it over on people and certain Romans believing it. And so you can't say the Romans created this, so how could the Romans fall? Well, that's not the same Romans.
I also think that you two gentlemen are kind of approaching the hoax idea a little different, whereas, and this is just my opinion from observing from the outside here a little, and maybe the watchers can attest to this, especially if you read the books. Dr. Scribina is showing that he is convinced that this is a hoax, like a purposeful fraud on a whole nother level, like through and through this is fraudulent. Whereas I think there's a lot more relaxed idea on James' side. He suggests that there's probably more good motivation, even though it might be set up as a tool politically. It's not just a absolute BS, I'm just trying to trick everybody type story. I think that there's real philosophical motivation, and maybe there's more authentic, there's passion from the authors that are really suggesting something and not in a fraudulent way. I think that's the difference, is you guys are coming at it like Dr. Scribina saying, guys, it's bullshit, and let's just call it what it is, and they're trying to infiltrate. Whereas I think James is saying, look, guys, I think they really believed, let's try to collaborate and connect with the society that we're in. I mean, we're not going to beat them by force. So at this point, and you both agree, this is the interesting part about this debate so far, is you both agree that in some way, you're either trying to covertly connect Rome to the Jewish people or Israel, or overtly or covertly, you know, take down this system. So both of you are kind of trying to come at this thing in an interesting way. So I'm going to do round seven. I think this was great. You guys are doing really good and you're very civil. So on round seven, I would like to have James ask the questions, allow Dr. Scribina, and then we'll go ahead and do our closing statements at 10 minutes apiece. You guys have been wonderful. And once we're done with the closing statements, if you guys would like to share a few words with one another, I'd love that. I don't really hear that often in debates. And then we can end this, maybe have a follow-up sometime. So number seven, let's get started. James, your questions.
Well, let's pick up right where we left off. It just seems to me that we have exactly what the Romans wanted in terms of changes in Judaism. And they were of urgent need to the Romans at the time because of the Jewish rebellion. And the misanthropy, the antisocial nature of it, it's all being directly addressed. The militancy, the nationalism, the Torah orthodoxy. It seems to check off a wish list of Roman desired changes in contemporary Judaism. And on the other hand, the idea that it would take out the Roman Empire, somehow destroy the Roman Empire, was completely lost. And Christians themselves became big advocates of the Roman Empire thereafter. It was never in the Christian mind to take them out. So how are we to believe Paul's motive in reality? How does that really work? How is Paul really thinking that this would bring down the Roman Empire by being submissive and no longer, you know, paying taxes, obeying the state, and so forth? Because Paul never really does call for any violence.
Right. So, well, again, right, so it works because it's directed to the Gentiles, not the Jews. I guess this is a basic disagreement, right? So you're continuing to say that the Christian story was targeted towards those militant Jews, those lunatic, violent guys, and what we're going to do, says the Romans, is we're going to impose on them a whole new worldview and a whole new ideology to brainwash them into becoming passive little sheep. And I don't know how that could possibly work. No one could have thought that was going to work. That's just an insane idea. That the Romans are thinking, let's just brainwash those fanatical Jews who are willing to die for their ideology. Let's just brainwash them to be passive little sheep. And boy, that will solve all of our problems. To me, that makes zero sense. No sense at all. What's far more likely is that Paul, in fact, was an apostle to the Gentiles. Let's go to the Gentiles and let's work on them. Let's soften them up. Let's undermine their strength, because they were supporting the Romans too. We need to undermine their support for Rome.
Well, how's
the focus is on the Gentiles.
How is
right?
it going to undermine them? How does that undermine him?
How does it
bring him down? Yeah, how does it bring him down?
Because
what's the mechanism by by which it's going to, this philosophy will
because,
hurt the Romans.
Because it pulls them into a Jewish worldview, a Jewish orbit, right? You're going to worshiping the Jewish God Jehovah. You're worshiping a Jewish rabbi named Jesus. You're preparing for this battle against the great Satan with all those militant passages that I just read. I mean, that does a pretty good job. And you're focusing them on the afterlife. You're telling them the meek will inherit the earth, will take over the world.
Again, the Romans embrace the afterlife. The Romans very much had a view of the afterlife and Neoplatonic spirituality and dualism. That was actually a Greek idea.
It's only the Christians who are promising the masses heaven if you fight against Satan. Fight against Satan in this world, and then we'll give you heaven when you die.
But you can't fight with violence. You have to turn the other cheek. And by turn the other cheek, it means you can't run away, you can't block the blow, you certainly can't fight back. Yeah. You've got to submit to blows. That means that Christians understood this to mean, you know, submit to the evildoer, turn the other cheek, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are the meek. Christians interpreted this to mean do not rebel. Be peaceful. I mean, we have Shakers, Amish, Quakers, monks, nuns. Cannot use violence at all. So, in fact, medieval church had to develop a doctrine of just wars. So the dominant message of the New Testament is a message of peace, is a message of assimilation, is a message of submission and obedience. It's not take up arms. So the only thing there I see that's anti-Roman is that there's the Jewish God we're worshiping. But as I say, the Romans were themselves backing into philosophical monotheism.
And the message of peace was supposed to convince the most militant fanatical Jews that they had to stop being militant and just lay down their arms and be sheep. And that was
because the reward is in the afterlife.
And that was actually expected to work. And even though it did not work, it did not work in the year 70, it didn't work in 115, and it didn't work in 135.
Well, I'm not
so
sure.
The Romans had nothing but failure from their grand plan to convert those Jews into being peace-loving sheep. Well, and they had nothing but failure from the story. That doesn't make any sense, right?
Well, what doesn't make any sense to me is let's turn into non-Jews, let's turn into Romans, and that'll defeat the Romans. Let's eliminate kosher diet, circumcision, let's introduce a man god, let's get rid of our concern about graven images, let's take away everything distinctive about being Jewish, let's in fact get rid of the Jewish calendar and Jewish holidays altogether to become Christians. No, let's become Romans. Let's adopt Neoplatonism and Stoicism as our philosophy, and let's be good, meek, mild, tax-paying, non-rebellious Romans. So how does that bring down the Roman Empire? I guess I don't understand the mechanism by which Paul would have thought that a message of obedience and peace and not obeying the Mosaic law would somehow destroy the Romans or help the Jews. To help the Jews, to turn them into Romans?
Yeah, what I've described, there is a kind
capitulation.
Of mechanism.
Capitulation is the mechanism.
The documentation is the mechanism by which that was promulgated.
The documentation
the
is it's a documentation of peace, a documentation of assimilation.
Yeah, but what's lacking is the mechanism on the other side. If I can ask you the same question, give me the mechanism by which the Roman emperor is going back to, at least Caligula or maybe even earlier. Suddenly got it in their head that we're going to convert those crazy Jews to some new...
There were violent disturbances from the beginning of the first century. There was a tax rebellion of Jewish Galilean...
Let me ask both of you gentlemen this, because I think this gets to the heart of what you're both trying to suggest, and I want to make it simple. Uh-huh. And I've noticed this prior, so people watching, I this is probably not a common debate style, but it's okay. You both, I think, are defining Satan differently here. And so when you were suggesting, Dr. Scribina, that fighting against Satan, of course, there are the hints of what appear put the armor on, the sword of, you know, these things that look like real overtly militant, you're saying are covertly. And James is asking, how are they supposed to fight Satan if Satan is Rome? And then I'd like to ask the same question back to you, James. If what is Satan to you? Is Satan the Jews, the militant Jews in this situation? Is this the rebellious spirit or the militant spirit that is fighting Rome? Do you have the exact opposite definition of what Satan is? But first to Dr. Scribina.
So the question is, how are you going to convert this metaphorical talk into real action? Is that
well? I mean, if Satan is Rome, and you're saying that they're to fight against Satan, how are they fight? Are they fighting in a let's do a total different philosophical approach to trying to defeat this?
Right.
In what way?
Right. So again, the pretext is you're promoting a message that you cannot say overtly because you'll get yourself killed. So it has to be in this metaphorical language. Paul must have known the trouble was brewing. He's living in the decades up to the first war. So he must have known, hey, war is in the air. I can barely hold back these militant Jews. There's going to be a fight. He knows there's going to be a fight. So what do? You talk to the masses and say, be prepared, armor of righteousness and the sword of justice and the helmet of this. Be prepared, Gentile masses. We'd sure love to have you on our side in the coming war rather than on the Roman side. I mean, to me, that makes perfect sense, right?
Okay. So before James, I got to ask, this is important for me to understand in our audience, I think. So technically, this is an overt way to draw on the masses for a real possible future battle that's coming, like a real sword and shield war. But he's not saying, hey, we're going to fight. Get ready. We're going to fight these Romans. You're saying he's gathering as many in to prepare for a real possible overt battle down the road. Now, James, Satan, who is he? And what is the... You said recently with Eisenman's idea, very interesting, that the Dead Sea Scrolls utilize very similar New Testament language, except Eisenman says, flip it upside down. Instead of fighting Rome,
precisely,
they're doing the opposite.
Exactly.
Can you go into that? And what is Satan in your view?
In the New Testament, Satan takes on, in a Neoplatonic sense, the worldly corrupting effect of matter itself, of material things. So to understand it in detail, Satan takes charge of Judas as he betrays Jesus. Satan takes charge of the Jewish crowd as they demand Jesus' crucifixion. Satan is an operative power in this world, for sure, but in a Neoplatonic sense. It's not that Satan is the Roman government. Quite the opposite. Jesus' praise for the centurion makes that clear. Pilate declares Jesus to be innocent in all four Gospels. The Eastern Orthodox Church canonized Pilate's wife. Pilate is the bad guy is a totally contemporary thing, almost a Hollywood thing, really. But
Satan is an evil spirit with the little horns and the tail and that whole
Satan
thing.
Is surely an evil spirit motivating the bad stuff that goes on in this world. And even Romans criticize their own emperors. Suetonius is a great example. It was just biography of the 12 Caesars. It tells you just how rotten. In fact, later emperors could criticize previous emperors. The Flavians didn't like Nero, and they were the ones pretty much responsible for the anti-Nero propaganda that we have in Suetonius. So Romans would rip on each other all the time and would accuse them of being no less than Satan as well. So it's not unusual for a Roman writer to call a Roman ruler, in effect, his equivalent of Satan. In the Jewish context, the idea of Satan in the Jewish context is attributed to the powers of this world. It's true, but it can be influencing all sorts of powers of this world. In the Gospels, it's really only the Jewish powers of this world that it's influencing. And in fact, throughout the New Testament, Romans never really get criticized. Paul directly says, obey the Roman state. He doesn't say this is for some later battle. He can discuss metaphorically armor, but what he says point blank is rebellion is a sin, pay your taxes. So any kind of, and if the Gospels are any indication, consider how Jesus fleshes that out. Like I say, turn the other cheek is a very radical doctrine of submission and peace. It precludes any kind of violent rebellion at all. So whoever's writing the Synoptic Gospels does not have any rebellion against Rome in mind, quite the opposite. He's creating a religion that will have to develop a special doctrine of just war 1,000 years later.
So Dr. Scribina, would you like to close just quick statement on that, and then we can get to our closing statements?
Yeah, I guess maybe nothing specific to respond. I mean, clearly the nature of Satan changes from the Old Testament to the New Testament, right? He's almost non-existent in the Old Testament. It's just a couple passing references in the whole book itself. So clearly something's happened, right? There's a connection in the New Testament, and I don't even know. I don't think it's a little bit in Paul. I'd have to look. I don't know how many references to Satan in Paul versus the Gospels, but clearly it's in that time where the Romans are the tangible enemy of the world. I mean, so it's hard. It's really hard to make an argument that this prominent view of Satan that shows up in the New Testament isn't somehow connected to the prominent evil from the Jewish perspective, which is the Romans. I mean, that's an obvious connection to make, and we see it explicitly in documents like the Book of Revelations. So you have a very hard argument to make if you're going to claim that that's something other than a stand-in for the Roman enemy.
Oh, I think it's a much harder argument to say that Satan is the Roman government. Paul wouldn't be saying obey them as God's agents on earth if they were Satan. Paul says they're God's agents on earth. Jesus says the centurion has more faith than any Jew. And he's not just a Roman, he's a centurion. And so we have to be careful about the powers of this world. Pilate thinks Jesus is innocent. Pilate is, if the effect of the story of the Gospels is to exonerate Pilate, not to implicate him. The purpose, the clear purpose, the obvious purpose, the purpose that Christians for the first 2,000 years of its history understood it to be. The Jews killed Jesus.
So, gentlemen, it sounds to me that the New Testament gospel canon is schizophrenic and or bipolar. It struggles with BPD. Because to me, I honestly think both of you gentlemen are probably right. Just my speculation at this point is there's truth probably to both of you guys in what you're suggesting here. And I know we're not done with the debate, but I have to praise both of you for handling that like gentlemen, doing very well. And James, good job on letting me get you to pause and that kind of
Sorry.
Stuff.
Notorious.
You should know him like I know him, Dr. Scribina. It's just, he's good. He's a very passionate guy. So Right. With that being said,
you
gentlemen were wonderful, and I love this. So let's get into the closing statements. And Dr. Scribina, you started us out. We'll start you on the closing. Then we'll get to James, and we'll go from there. 10 minutes starting.
Yeah, just a short statement. I won't even need the whole 10 minutes. But I guess, I really want to, because we're really arguing about plausibility, because we don't have actual anything counts as proof, because the documentation is virtually non-existent, right? So we're arguing on a very sketchy body of facts. And we're trying to argue what's the plausible explanation for these facts, right? So, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to draw from obvious facts of human nature, what we know from independent sources, what we know from non-Jewish and non-Christian sources about attitudes towards the Jews, Jewish attitudes towards their superiors, long-running conflicts, sort of the hatred of humanity that comes out of the Jewish tradition. And you can see that very easily turning into a kind of a weaponizing of a religion, using against the masses, using against the Romans to try to undermine their strength, their confidence, their morality, their spirituality. I mean, to me, that's a pretty obvious thing. It's well documented, this antipathy on both sides. I did that in my book. The military conflicts, we have the history of the Zealots and the Sicarii movement. So we know that they've had these deadly violent conflicts between both sides. To me, we look at the documents and you have to look at the actual sort of passages as well. And I think maybe this is one strength that I've tried to emphasize. And maybe I'd like to throw it on James to do a little bit more is to find more of the textual basis for his claims. And I think, I've been able to cite documents and passages that are, I think, are pretty consistent with a hoax thesis. And James is making a lot of assertions, but assertions, aren't really, they don't carry that much weight unless you can back them up with what we can say, right? So you need to tie them to more documentation, right? I mean, if you want to say that Paul is pro-Roman and you only have Romans 13 out of 13 letters that you can point to and you can quote to, I mean, that's a pretty weak statement. If you've got the Gospel of Mark and you've got one passage, Mark 12:17, and that's the only passage you can point to, I mean, the evidence is really pretty thin, and you need to build up the evidence in terms of an actual concrete citation of the sources, so to speak, that will support that case. Because prima facie, it doesn't seem like it makes sense that the Romans are going to create an anti-Jewish ideology and a theology, and they're going to sell that to the militant Jews, and they're holding their fingers crossed and saying, gee, I hope that stops the fighting. It doesn't make sense. It didn't make sense. It didn't work. It failed in the year 70. It failed in 115. It failed in 135. So if that was the plan, it was an abject failure. I don't know. And to me, the hoax thesis, of course, in the end wins. It does play a role in undermining the empire. James admitted that. We see that in even people like Gibbons and others have said, well, look, the Christian ideology did have a role in undermining the strength of the Roman Empire and contributing to its collapse. So, I mean, when you look at the facts of history, the documents that we have, the quotations, the passages that we have, to me, it just seems like it's a much more consistent story to say somebody constructed this lie. It came out of the Jewish community. We have every reason to pin it on Paul and maybe his friends, James and and the John and the Matthew and the Luke and the gospel writers, we can pin it on them because they were the names attached to those documents. Everything sort of adds up to that's the most plausible solution. And any counter solution has to have a better, stronger argument with better documentation. And I guess that's what I would like to see on James's behalf. So I'll leave it at
you,
that.
You still have 6 minutes. Are you
sure?
No,
that's okay. That's okay.
Okay, he's capitulating the 6 minutes. Awesome. James, you are up for your 10 minutes starting now.
Documentation is, I have loads of, starting with the nativity stories, right? Joseph and Mary are complying with the Roman census in an age of Jewish rebellion. Jesus befriends tax collectors. Jesus praises a Roman centurion. Jesus, whose only foils are Jewish authorities, never Roman authorities. And the message Jesus teaches is uniformly a message of peace. If he says, I accidentally came to bring the sword, well, that's the effect. That's not you, the Christian. You, the Christian, have to submit to the evildoer. He says it point blank, submit to the evildoer. You have to turn the other cheek. You, blessed are the peacemakers. The message of Jesus is uniformly one of peace and meekness and mildness in, again, an age of Jewish rebellion. It's not just one or two passages. It's every single passage in the New Testament, practically. In fact, all the arguments of anti-Romanists on his part are what lacks textual basis because it's some kind of subtle argument. Satan equals Romans. Elemental powers equals... No. On the face of it, Paul says, obey the Romans. And not just obey the Romans in this age of rebellion, but obey them as God's appointed agents on earth. Rebellion is a sin. Pilate, the whole Pilate passion narrative is designed to exonerate the Roman state and has no other purpose. Pilate declares Jesus to be innocent in all four Gospels, when, of course, if there was a historical Jesus, the Jewish authorities simply would have had him stoned. If he was crucified by the Romans, it wasn't for saying, pay your taxes. So the entire story itself is a parable. Jesus being a non-military Messiah is itself an affront to the Jewish rebellion. Everything about the New Testament turns the ideology of the Jewish rebellion on its head and is a message of peace, rendering unto Caesar, pay your taxes, compliance. And in fact, it takes the whole charged, militant notion of Messiah, removes it from this earth. They are all false messiahs, and puts it into another dimension. My kingdom is not of this earth. Completely defanging the political effect of Messiah, which is exactly what the Romans wanted. Now, the Romans were fighting a rebellion against the Jews. They did not simply rely on an ideological front, but surely they would have had an ideological front. No, it was not successful in undermining the Jewish rebels altogether. Paul could not prevent the first war, and the Gospels could not prevent the second and third rebellions. No, of course not. But to what extent were they successful? We'll never know. We'll never know. But what is paradoxical is that the New Testament creates Messiah who is a pacifist or a peace-loving Messiah. That's a paradox. Messiah, the Messianic Jews were the militant Jews. Our ancient sources like Josephus and Suetonius and Tacitus all tell us that it was the Messianic prophecies of the Jews that most inspired the Jewish war. And so the concept of Messiah is being turned on its head in the form of Jesus, undermining the entire purpose, ideological stimulus of the war is being addressed ideologically by the Romans. The Romans would have fought the Jews both on the battlefield and ideologically. It makes perfect sense that there would be a propaganda component because the Romans used propaganda components in their warfare. If there was no propaganda component in the Jewish war, where is it? The propaganda component of the Jewish war that the Romans used was the New Testament. The fact that we have here and there vague references, bleed-throughs of disciples carrying weapons, for example, or apocalyptic literature in which vaguely have analogies that say it's Rome, aren't very convincing because, as I say, Romans often complained about previous Romans. But they did hold the average person is not the elite. That is to say, whether it's the Jewish elite or the Roman elite, they would be talking to the masses in a way that would persuade them to their ends, whatever those ends are. So the question is it more plausible to believe that this message of peace and submission and pay your taxes was designed to undermine the Roman Empire as a tactic of the rebels? Or is it more plausible to say that this message of peace was in fact a critical reaction to, a propaganda reaction to, the Jewish militants who created the rebellions in the first few centuries? In my view, there's no question. The New Testament is a critical reaction to the militant, nationalist, Torah-Orthodox rebels, messianic Jewish rebels of the first two centuries.
That worked out to 5 minutes and 30 seconds remaining. So you both took about the same time out of respect. I just gave you 10 in case. Let's let you two, close out with a little bit of dialogue here. And then maybe, just maybe, we can focus in on particulars, maybe even get into why you guys think particular passages are thinking certain ways, because your interpretive method of some of these particular documentation, if you will, the textual ideas, we can go into maybe some other day in another debate where we can go into something like that. But if you guys would like to discuss freely here, that'd be awesome. And then I'll close this out.
Well, I guess I still have this kind of question, if I can throw it out there, right? That somehow this story that came from the Romans, and it had to go way back. You know, to me, it probably had to go back to Tiberius, and it had to run through Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, Titus, Vespasian, Domitian. This whole massive time, multiple emperors and different families and dynasties, and all through that whole time, they're maintaining this consistent crazy story of a Jewish rabbi who died in saving humanity.
There's no suggestion of that. In fact, the letters of Paul.
Exactly.
In fact, the letters.
Right?
That's right. And so that's why I never said that such a thing happened. The Gospels weren't written until the Flavian dynasty. And the details and the particulars of that weren't even worked out until the Flavian dynasty, I suspect.
Yeah, but the kernel of that story had to go back to Tiberius. The kernel of the story was there, and it got supplemented and built on over time.
Maybe it does, but it's such a stupid little nugget. A dude who got crucified, that it wasn't much to maintain. But there's no indication that Tiberius was behind this or that Claudius gave it approval. No, in Paul's letters are the first time we get this. Before Paul, we're looking at the Jewish militants. Now you ask, what is the mechanism? There are a lot of prominent, well-educated Jews who are very close with the Roman emperors throughout the first century. Claudius is very close with Herod Agrippa, right? They grew up together. His mother, Antonia, the daughter of Mark Antony, the niece of Augustus, calls Herod Agrippa her son. It's like a foster son of hers. They're that close, elite Jews and Romans. In the Flavian dynasty, Titus, the emperor, he almost marries Berenice, the granddaughter of Herod Agrippa I. They're that close. Josephus, for example, is a well-educated Jewish person working and collaborating with the Romans. It is these Jewish elites who created Christianity. They're working hand in hand with the Romans. For these Jewish elites, a non-Torah Orthodox version of Judaism would be very convenient for Josephus, for Berenice, for Tiberius Alexander, for Philo's nephews. So there are these Jews, well-educated Jews, who are working with Romans. They're the ones who come up with Christianity.
Yeah, but again, I don't understand how this possibly works. Tiberius gets in his idea.
What's your problem? Tiberius doesn't come up with it.
Well, hold on. He says, we got a problem with those Jews, man. Those guys are a pain in the ass. And he calls his Jewish buddies in and says, hey, you got your fellow co-religionists over there in Judea. Figure out something to shut those guys up because they're a pain in the ass. And they sit in a room and they think, what can we do?
So what story do you think was invented during Tiberius? How much of the story do you think was derived in the 30s?
Well, at least you got a Jewish rabbi who was crucified, died, raised to heaven, and died for everybody's sins.
Why do you say it had to be there? Why do you say that much even had to be there?
Because that's in Paul's letters as of 50.
Right, so why did that have to be as early as the 30s?
Well, it had to be somewhere between Tiberius and Caligula and Claudius, because that's where the
could have been 49.
Well, let's see. Okay, I suppose just the other day.
Well, but you're imputing it back, and not only that, you're imputing it back into specific minds. We don't have any such knowledge, nor do we need it. It's clear that it's following Roman goals, Roman agenda. It's designed to pacify. It's addressed to militant messianic Jews. It's addressed. Yeah, it's a message of peace addressed to Messianic Jews in the first century. On the face of it.
It doesn't matter if it was Tiberius or Caligula or Claudius.
Agreed.
One of those three said, the Jews are a pain in the ass. They call their Jewish buddies in and they say, think of something to shut those guys up. And they come up with this Jesus story.
Right.
They say, hey, boss, we got a good idea. We're going to convince those fanatical Jews that Jesus died for the sins. And Jesus said, be peace loving and blah, blah, blah. And Caligula says, yeah, I like that idea. Go for it. And then they go out and they bribe Paul, because Paul doesn't know shit about any of this stuff.
No, so Paul may well have been already a person working for Herod.
So they throw him a bunch of money, and they throw thousands of coins, denarii at Paul. Hold on.
Why are you doing
this? They bribe the hell out of Paul, and they say, Paul, we invented this story. Here, shut up and read this, and now go out and sell it to your fellow Jews. Well, that's what you're telling us.
No,
that's
I'm not.
What you're telling us.
No, I'm not.
Then what are you telling us?
Paul may have been the inventor of it. There may have been committee meetings. There may have been scholars behind this. I don't know the mechanism. I'm not claiming that the Roman emperors were the ones who devised the details of the story. Where do you get that? The idea is, of course, that the New Testament is consistently following a pro-Roman agenda, an agenda of paying your taxes, peace, submitting to the Romans, turning the other cheek, obeying the government as God's agent on earth. Since what we're doing is we're taking what is a militant problem for the Romans, a serious problem, the most important military issue of the age, and we're addressing militant Messianic Jews with a message of peace. On the face
well,
of it,
Paul thought probably, of this. You got to have a theory, James. It's got to be somebody.
I do not have a theory. No, I do not need to know that. You don't know that. You don't even know it from your standpoint.
It's not my theory. It's your theory.
But I mean, those kind of details you can't provide. In other words, we don't need those kind of minutiae. We do know on the face of it that the New Testament follows lockstep a Roman political agenda of the first century.
Well, gentlemen, this was good. I got to give it to you guys. That was really good. I'm glad you guys came out with a spark here. I get where both of you are coming from. I think anybody watching that can really understand both of where you're coming from. I really appreciate this. And thanks for letting me host it.
Thank you, Derek. This is a great forum. You do. If I may say it as an atheist, you do the Lord's work, Derek.
Thank God we have you.
Thank God we have Derek. Exactly. And thank God we have you too, Professor Scrivina. Thank you.
Yeah, this was wonderful. I plan on doing further shows, of course, with both of you gentlemen. I'd really be looking forward to delving into more details on a show with you, Dr. Scrivina, on how you are interpreting some of these things, because that is a big difference, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who are watching. Both of these gentlemen are viewing the evidence with good reason, with differences, okay? And not saying either one of you guys are wrong or right. I think I get why both of you are coming at the angle that you are, which is what makes such a close yet so far apart theory an interesting debate. Nobody does this. Nobody's done a debate like this. There have been writings That's about true. Guys like this, pro-Roman, anti-Roman Jesus, etc. But nobody's debated it on, at least not that I'm aware of, anywhere on YouTube. And you guys are the first. So congratulations to that.
Thank you.
And thank you guys. Look, ladies and gentlemen, get the Creating Christ book, get the Jesus Hoax. They're down in the description. So you can go to their websites, JesusHoax.com. You can go to thecreatingchrist.com. And of course, all the links will be down there, as well as hit that subscribe button, hit that like button. Don't forget to comment. Who do you think won the debate? And if you're like me and you say, hey, there's pros and cons, weigh it out. Comment down below. It helps this channel grow, too. The algorithm makes this channel grow so we can keep bringing you this content. With that being said, thank you so much, Dr. Scrivina. I really appreciate you joining me, sir.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And James Stevens Valiant.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you, guys.